Hello, welcome to Love Letters Live. Today we are going to talk again to David Fitzgerald, who spoke recently about his search for the truth leading to atheism. And we talked about his first book, Nailed. You say the title.
Nailed, 10 Christian Myths That Show Jesus Never Existed at All.
Okay, show Jesus never existed at all. I couldn't help but smiling and thinking how combative. Until I heard David, and I didn't say it, and then David said, that's very provocative. Yes, it is. And the truth of the matter is, David does not have a combative thing about him, or in his whole life as an atheist. You would think that maybe that went hand in hand, but it does not. I asked David to come back to talk about his second book, and you please say the title, and then you talk about that, because...
I'd love to. This book series is called The Complete Heretic's Guide to Western Religion.
Now, that's the whole series that
that's
you do is
series.
Going,
And this is book one in that series. It's called The Mormons, and it's all about that fascinating, thoroughly American religion.
Okay, tell us about that. For those who don't know what it means to be a Mormon or how that came to be or the man who put it together, would you just talk about that and
where
you diverged and had to start looking for truth?
Sure. Actually, I really imagine that nobody out there has not heard of the Mormons because they're so pervasive. They're so out there.
I would imagine that too, and I've learned to assume nothing.
Very fair enough. Well, for those of you who don't know, Mormonism is a spinoff of Christianity. Like most forms of Christianity, they would say that they're the one true version of Christianity. But most Christians don't even consider them part of the Christian family, because their doctrines have spun off in this completely different direction.
You'll tell us about that.
My book, actually, the first part of the book, the first third, is sort of like a secret history of Mormonism, how it got started especially, and
why is it considered a secret history?
Well, it's because it's things that the church doesn't necessarily want anyone to know.
Except for the Mormons.
No, they don't even want the Mormons to know.
Oh, really?
Okay. Don't even want the Mormons to know.
Okay.
And part of that is because of the problematic way that the religion started. And it started with one guy in the early 19th century in upstate New York, Palmyra. And there's really no polite way to put it. It started from a con artist making stuff up and went on from there.
Well, how do you document that, shall we say? I mean, what makes you say he was? This is Joseph Smith.
Joseph Smith
was a known con artist.
In fact, that's exactly how I start the book, with one of his trials for being a con artist.
Really,
he practiced a thing called glass looking. It was this a very common practice at the time to claim to have necromantic powers and to be able to commune with spirits and see where hidden treasures were and things like that. And that's how he got in trouble in 1826.
Because he was charging for it?
He was painting himself as a stone seer and, mm-hmm. A glass looker and conning wealthy backers.
Okay. So that's the charge, not just believing.
That was the charge,
okay.
Yeah. Had nothing to do with Mormonism at the time until years later, after he'd started the religion. He, in his story, this was supposedly the time that he was had been visited by Jesus and angels and, God, and was preparing himself, to become worthy of receiving the Book of Mormon. And in fact, it was just a year and a half after his conviction for fraud on these. And that's sort of his story in a nutshell. It's an amazing story of just how far you can get on just sheer chutzpah and just...
On the other hand, if I may, because I know you go to places where you actually talk about this and have the discussion or the argument.
I do.
You can be, first of all, the fact that he was charged and prosecuted or convicted as a con artist,
yeah.
On the one hand, doesn't mean that his next thing was a con. I mean, isn't every offense its own separate, you can't use one as evidence for the other?
That is true, except that according to his later story, this was all during, he misrepresented himself at one point or the other, but he can't have it both ways. Either he was lying when he said that this was a time when he was preparing himself to receive the true gospel, or he was lying when he was convicted of fraud,
And did he come out and admit to the fraud?
Well,
ever?
I don't know that he admitted it to it, but he was found guilty of it.
No, but there's something different than a person saying, oh, yeah, okay, you got me.
I see what you're saying. Well, you know, there are occasions during his career where he did break down, like to his father-in-law,
who
did not want his daughter to marry this guy. And he broke down and said, yeah, yep, I'll reform my ways and not do those things anymore and become a good guy and settle down. And,
okay, so how did this become a religion? How did the plates and the...
Right. Well, as the story goes, and one of the things I bring out in the book is it's not just one story. There's an official story, but that's like six or seven stories in line.
Do you know the official stories and the secret things?
I do. I do. And that's a big chunk of the book is how the story began and how different it was when it was just him sort of just saying something to his family just for fun. And how it sort of just snowballed into something else. And
you know what that's in your book?
It is.
Okay,
it
so
is.
Say it's the title again, because we don't have enough time to talk about that and the secrets. So
right. It's called The Complete Heretic's Guide to Western Religion, Book 1, The Mormons, by David Fitzgerald.
David Fitzgerald, and you might want to read that. I certainly do. Okay.
And all the Christians who really didn't like my first book, they seem to love the second
book. Oh, because they're not so fond of the Mormons?
Well,
isn't
you know.
That's funny how...
Yeah.
And what do they like about it?
Well, they say it's very readable, and it's very funny.
And it's not about them.
And it's not about them, exactly. But it's chock full of information. It starts out with, like I say, a secret history, and then it kind of goes into their more strange beliefs and where those came about. And the last part of the book, actually, is just how to talk to Mormons about being Mormons without being a jerk about it.
Oh, nice. This is so definitely your personality.
Mm.
Because you talk to people with such respect. I have a question. Your first book was to show that Jesus Christ did not exist at all.
Right.
What is the second one to show? Because I think an honest history of something doesn't necessarily make it part of the heretic series, right?
Well, in this case, I mean, I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek.
Right.
But it's kind of kidding on the square. I really do mean it, that the religion itself, Mormonism, is a complete con job.
It's
a complete
travesty. Oh, I see. So that's it.
This is disputing that. And just making the point that for Mormons, it's not just something they believe in. If you can just disprove A, they'll go to B. It's their whole world. It's their whole universe. It's their history. They have a whole secret history of the world that's different from anybody else's, and they think that...
Can you tell us what that is?
Oh, sure. It's things like the Garden of Eden is actually... Any guesses where the Garden of Eden actually is?
Oh, New Jersey?
Close.
Elmira.
It's in Independence, Missouri. Missouri. Because Joseph Smith had a vision that told him that's where it was. And that was going to be ground zero for when Jesus comes back. That will be Zion. And one of many, many funny, ironic things is that the Mormon church actually doesn't own ground zero where the Garden of Eden was and where Jesus is coming back. That belongs to a splinter group of Mormonism.
Oh.
And there's just hilarious little ironic things like that.
If you can learn something from the concept of the Garden of Eden and creation, if you can learn something, let's say it's not true, but you can learn something from stories. You can learn valuable things from stories.
You're always willing to give them a fair shake. I love that.
Well, I mean, all of us, we learn things about story. And thank you for
And
that.
You know what? And when there and there is truth in myth.
The whole yeah,
profound
exactly.
truth in poetry and myth, but it's when we mistake myth for fact, the truth in myth and the truth in empirical facts.
Okay, so
when things get troubled.
If you mistake the myth for truth
right.
and then use it as your club to dominate others,
exactly.
we're really on
exactly.
a rotten ride.
Exactly.
And to that's hell, which you probably also don't think exists.
I can trace the evolution. I can trace the evolution of that idea. Because the ancient Hebrews didn't believe in hell.
That's right.
They believed in Sheol, you know, the land of the gloomy little underground land of the dead where everybody went, regardless of where they
were. For a time.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And that those ideas changed and percolated and ideas from the Babylonians. And
that's another thing. Ideas percolate and change, so they do evolve.
Oh, absolutely.
And be far from... So, but what I was going to say is, if you can learn something from the Garden of Eden, it doesn't matter where it is. It might as well be in Missouri.
Well...
Because it's in here.
Yeah. It's what...
Point
gets
it to my
problematic.
Head.
Yes, as she does. The problem with it is, again, when you... you can have your own opinions, you can have your own poetry, you can have myth, but you can't have your own facts. And so it's not just
true.
A problem of them saying that the Garden of Eden's in the wrong place. Uh-huh. It's the fact that their whole worldview is built on this tissue of lies, one after another, and it makes them do things that that aren't good for them and otherwise.
Oh, like what?
Well, they get taken advantage of. One of the things that surprised me and shocked me in the book was stumbling on the fact that Utah is the con artist capital of the whole nation. And often as not, it's
not
other
their national
Mormons,
motto.
It's yeah. other Mormons preying on other Mormons.
So can you give some examples?
Oh,
I mean, unfortunately, people prey on their own.
Sure. But I mean, I stumbled on, while researching one particular case of a bishop who was defrauding his flock, I stumbled on like 30 different Ponzi schemes throughout the last 20 years or so, and I was just stunned. I mean, it was completely put a nickel in and got a jackpot pot of.
And how did those Ponzi schemes work? What were they based on?
They were
selling.
They were all different. A lot of them were like typical pyramid schemes where it's like, okay, we've got this small little knit group and. You're going to have a sales opportunity and
but what are
you'll
they selling?
Get money. Oh, it was all different things. Uh-huh. Some were multinational cleaning product organizations.
Oh, I see.
Some were just real estate fraud. Some were
so the issue
was
just
different.
That they were taking advantage,
they were
of,
taking
each
advantage
other.
Of each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Because that's who they knew.
And that's who they knew.
Yeah.
And when I was researching the history, you know, I always knew that Joseph Smith was a character. I always knew Brigham Young was, a bit of a bastard, but I had no idea how many others. There was this whole rogue gallery.
Oh, so pick up from Brigham Young then and the move to Utah.
Yeah, well, by the time Brigham Young came on board, I mean, Mormonism was well and truly off the rails by then.
Off the rails meaning on its way to being something?
Well, no, yeah, it was.
Or off the rails meaning like the tragus?
Well, both.
Okay.
Both. I mean, it was that little fledgling religion. Just kept growing and growing and growing.
Mm-hmm.
And it kept getting knocked back and persecuted. And that persecution, I mean, we think of persecution as being, something that religions must be true because they were persecuted. And no, it's not true. It's actually most religions that survive because they are persecuted. And it binds them together in a way that, you know, it eliminates all the looky-loos and all the half-hearted. And the ones that are left, they double down. And the more they suffer, the deeper they are devoted to the religion. It's perverse and fascinating, but it's we see that
think,
in a lot of
different
religions.
What do you think it was? I mean, if people could be Christian,
mm-hmm.
and that was certainly a viable religion with a lot of good advice and ways to live, and why would people not choose that? What was appealing about Mormon?
Well, one of its early successes is that it claimed to be the real Christianity. So people who joined it, other Christians hated it, but the people who actually joined up thought that this was, you know, a new revelation of Jesus Christ.
So it was kind of an honest thing that they went for. They
oh,
wanted
I think
to
so.
Be part of the truest.
And they weren't the brightest bulbs. They had great hearts, but they weren't the most discerning. This was the same generation that gave us, like, the legend of Ichabod Crane and Sleepy Hollow Rip Van Winkle. There was folk magic and folk, you know, conjurmen and spells and spirits and spooks,
mm-hmm.
that was just part of their reality. That was really ingrained in that time.
Rip Van Winkle was an interesting thing. I mean, I happen to be a real fan of that whole genre.
Yeah.
Where people are just lost. I saw Blast from the Past last night on television, which was a Rip Van Winkle story about, you know, you've missed 40 years and you come out into. So how did that fit into what you're saying?
Well, it's just that they were willing to believe that there was all kinds of spirits and fairies and things that were done in day-to-day life.
Okay.
And if it, you know, if you could treasure hunt by using dowsing sticks, things like that.
So it was
a very rich, full, out there mythology. And what one of the genius things that Joseph Smith did was he put in, you know, they had just discovered mastodon bones, you know, a few years back. So he put elephants in his Book of Mormon, you know. So it looked, oh my goodness, this is amazingly prescient, you know, it must be true. And one preacher at the time said, this book contains every great idea and every idiotic notion of the last 10 years in this book. And there were lots of other people.
Something for everyone.
Something for everyone. And there were lots of other people who wondered where the Indians came from thought it must be a lost tribe of Israel. That was not an uncommon idea, and it goes right
in. And that's not an uncommon idea, by the way. I find it kind of touching. Everybody wants to belong.
For sure.
And suddenly, you know, if you have no particular discernible history that you can find or document, you're a lost tribe of Israel, and there you go, you've got a great group.
Yep, yep. And they're still doing that in, like, Samoa and places in the South Pacific.
In terms of Mormon?
Mormons, yeah. Of saying, oh, these are actually lost Jews, and that somehow makes them better. It's like as if them being Indian or Samoan wasn't good enough already.
Right.
You know, they had to be the chosen people. That's sort of the other flip side of Mormonism is that it's not, you know, we've kind of see the good side because it's 150 so years in, and now they're trying so hard to be normal and being family oriented and push those positive values, but it's so racist it hurts when you look at what they believed and what they believed about Indians and what they believed about black people, and just the idea that the Mesoamerican civilizations, oh, they had been done by white people because clearly Indians couldn't have built this amazing stuff.
Oh, yeah, no, that's a whole that's a whole other issue.
It's so racist it hurts, you know.
Yes. So what was go back to Brigham Young and what he was like and what he did. And aren't most, I'm going to say something probably so, okay, I'm going to get skewered for
this.
Now. I don't care. Most people who start religions and who are able to carry huge groups of people with them have the kind of charisma that is borderline something.
Absolutely.
I mean, look at Ataturk. Look at...
Sure. Well, and Joseph Smith was that in spades. He was just the quintessential woman chasing, women loved him, you know, men wanted to follow him everywhere.
That's what you have
charisma.
To be to start a religion.
Absolutely.
Everybody has to love you and want to follow you.
And he also had the good fortune of dying young, and so, boom, the instant martyr, and so they loved him even more. He actually was in a prison, or a jail cell, and a mob came and killed him. The story has it that he went to his death willingly, but what they don't say is he also had a gun in his hand, and he and his brother actually shot at people who were attacking them.
How did he come to be the head of it?
Well, he was the driving force behind it originally. Joseph Smith was.
Right.
The thing that made the switch after that, as soon as he died, there was this huge succession crisis in the church.
Yes.
And all these different ones came forward to say that, oh, Joseph Smith wanted me to be. Wanted me. And that succession crisis kind of fascinated, too, seeing all the... Because one guy came up and he had, oh, look, here's another book of plates. But unlike the gold plates that Joseph talked about but no one ever saw... This guy actually had a real set of fake brass plates that told the story, you know.
Brigham Young did.
No. This was a different guy altogether. So, the church actually splintered at that time. Mm-hmm. And Brigham Young was not the most popular, but he was the strongest and was able to take the biggest chunk of people with him. And that's what we know as Mormonism today. That's the official church.
I mean, also what we know of Mormon, I mean, I've known several Mormons.
Sure.
Smart, hardworking,
absolutely,
wonderful, dear human beings. And they must see something. Well, I know they do.
Sure.
And then, of course, you see those beautifully dressed, lovely people who are going house to house.
Yeah.
They're working hard at it.
They are. Just like the Jehovah's Witnesses. And I'll be tackling them in a book down the line, too, as well.
So you're still going after people should know the whole truth about
every group. Exactly. And, I mean, I am an atheist. I don't think religion is good for us, ultimately.
And is that your when you say you're an atheist, because you're such a, we talked about this last time, I think, you're such a cheerful, open, you can say anything to me kind of man.
Yeah.
So the atheism part of you is your conviction that you think religion is not good for us.
Right. And it's like the good parts of religion, there are plenty of good parts of religion, but they would be good even without all the baggage of all the things that are just patently false and harmful in religion.
Now, but the future of these religions seems as secure as can be.
That was another surprise for me, actually.
The Mormon
church, I think they have maxed out, even though for a while it looked like they were just going to be on this complete roll because they were growing. But one of the biggest surprises for me is to see that their numbers that they claim have been inflated by like a magnitude of 3 times. There's 3 times as many ex-Mormons as there are active Mormons.
Oh, let's talk about ex-Mormons.
Oh, ex-Mormons are my favorite.
Go ahead.
I talk to so many people, just current Mormons and ex-Mormons, and researching this book. And one reoccurring theme that almost all of them had in common was that the church lied to me. And that was the thing that they really could not forgive the church for.
Do they say how?
there are many different ways. I mean, there have been plenty of opportunities for them to lie. A lot of it about the archaeology of Mormonism. It's just completely made up. And it's not just made up and completely made up, but it's demonstrably made up because we still have some of the original texts that, you know, Joseph Smith wound up getting his hands on some Egyptian funerary texts and saying, oh, look, this is the Book of Abraham written by his own hand while he was in Egypt, and this says this, and this says this. And it's just what he didn't realize is that even while he was starting his religion and just spinning these stories out of pure cloth, people were already starting to decipher hieroglyphics. Mm-hmm. And so he was putting smoking guns in his mouth throughout his whole career. And now we actually have one of the texts that supposedly this cornerstone of Mormon scripture is based on. And it's just a common funerary text that we can completely read. You
know. What is it they promise people?
They give big ticket items. Okay. They don't just believe there's
heaven.
They believe there's three heavens. And if you're a good Mormon, you can go to the third heaven and there's
right away
levels of that. Oh, yeah, yeah. And not only that, but it's very Dungeons and Dragons. It reminds me of being in eighth grade again because it's just like, you know, and if you become a 20th level Mormon, you can go and live with Jesus. And if you get super duper Mormon, eventually you can you know, spin off and start your own universe with your family.
So you can be Jesus.
You can be Jesus. You can be God. Uh-huh. All these things. It's pretty fascinating. I like to call it. I call it steampunk Scientology in the book.
Oh, I was okay. So what? I was going to ask you if you were going to. I mean, you probably will. You're young yet. You've got a lot of time, and there are a lot of religions. But Scientology. That is another really interesting.
It's very interesting.
And you hear about. Within the Mormon Church, and of course these are individuals. This does not reflect. I mean, that's important to say.
That's true for every religion.
Yes,
yeah.
People who misuse it and who end up molesting children and doing horrible things.
Yeah, and there's some real horror stories coming out of the fringes of Mormonism.
Right, and that's the people.
Yeah,
not the religion. I just think that's important for because you say
My quote.
Do it again.
Religion makes good people better and bad people worse.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
And yeah, I think it's true. But I think, and I think I may have said
this last
week.
But that's not part of the lying to me. I mean, that's just another horror. Right. Okay.
But when you do start lying to people for whatever reason, there's consequences of it. It acts as a cancer because you have to support these lies and you have to, you know, you have to expend all this energy and quell all these doubts. It's just toxic. It just builds up.
Yes. And I'm sure, you know, in some way, it's big business. I mean, you see that in all kinds of, in the Vatican, and you see it in
absolutely
in the centers of a lot of, but.
You know what, I got to tell you, if churches just paid taxes on just the non-church holdings, like their in the case of the Mormons, they've got radio stations, they've got cattle ranches, they've got, you know, hotel chains, I mean, media outlets. They have billions of dollars worth of investment. If they just pay taxes on that, you know.
Oh, they don't have to pay taxes on anything because they're a
church?
There's
so much they don't have to pay tax on because it's a church holding.
That should be corrected.
Yeah. Yeah. But same thing applies to the Vatican's, the Southern Baptist Convention, any of these churches, these religions. They've, you know, I understand why the Founding Fathers originally wanted, you know, to protect the little local, you know, Baptist church down on the corner, but we're so far from that now.
Also, if the Mormons have a great deal of money,
but
do they do for their own? Do they hospitals and they care for people?
They do.
And they take care
of.
So I can see wanting it for that.
Sure. But it's also they also extract at a high price. I mean, you have to get your tithe in.
You pay the tithe.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you get something for it.
Yeah.
But I know we're off the subject.
Yeah, a bit.
Okay. So you talk about Western religions.
Mm.
Your focus is Western religions,
and really the only reason for that is because those are the ones I know, and those are the ones that seem to have the most clout in America.
Does religion have the same kind of dominating force in Eastern religions, or is it?
You know, I think I do, but it's a different dynamic. Mm-hmm. In there, it's not so. and I don't want to mischaracterize this. I was just going to say, in here, you have all these competing religions, and they all claim to be the one true faith. Mm-hmm. Over there, you have all these competing sects, but they don't claim to be exclusive. They all, you know, they
want to dominate, but they don't claim to.
They do. And, I mean, they do. There are feuds in Eastern religion just as nasty and as upsetting as anything we get in Western. It's not this benevolent glow, coming from the East. But just the way people's lives and religion interact, it just seems to be a bit different in Eastern.
Okay, so you have what was the one you said was coming next? Not Scientology.
No, the book I'm working on now is called Jesus Mything in Action.
Oh.
It's a follow up to Nailed, and it's going to be talking about the arguments that I get from atheists who try to tell me we have good reason to believe there was a Jesus, even just a guy named Jesus. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to respond to that.
Arguments you get from non-atheists.
Oh, no, from atheists themselves.
Oh, really? Then I'm confused. Why would atheists themselves,
why would they care, or why would they say? Yeah, I'm baffled by it as much as you are.
Okay, I thought I misunderstood.
I think what's happening is in the case of that, there's a consensus in biblical historical circles that even if they don't believe Jesus was divine, they believe that there was a first century Palestinian Jew who was a rabbi and was crucified by the Romans.
Uh-huh.
And I don't have any problem with that. If my world wouldn't be devastated if it turns out that's true, but I just don't think that's true. Mm-hmm. And I've got reasons for that.
So I like the way you say my world wouldn't be devastated if. Because even if, I'm guessing, just from what I know you, and I know you better since the last time we spoke in this, even if everything you were saying right now came out not to be true, it wouldn't be devastating because it would be more of your path on the search for truth.
Exactly. And I would be happy to write a third book recanting all that.
Okay, interesting.
And it's funny because in my last chapter of the Nailed book, I list all these things that would be different if I was wrong. You know, it's not just me. I don't want to give the idea that it's my ideas. Most of these ideas have been around for hundreds of years or more. Mm-hmm. I just feel like a war correspondent reporting from the trenches.
I think that's what you sound like. And also, you're the one that's taking it up now to make people aware of what's on the other side
of
the hill.
And I'm far from the other one. There's lots and lots of people.
This is such an interesting world.
Isn't it, though?
Yes.
Isn't it, though?
And I never knew it was such an interesting world. It seemed like kind of a one post, what do you call it? One hitching post town where there was one horse and one idea. And I just had no, I didn't know it was so varied and with so many possibilities. Thank you for doing this with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for opening my eyes. This is so interesting. Until next, and we're not going to talk about your love letter this time because we did last time. And you were going to do one to all the people who thought they were alone. And you were going to mail it to yourself in your own handwriting and see what happens. But I had another thought, just because I do have a large part of the devil in me, is writing love letters to the founders of these religions. Writing a love letter to Joseph Smith and Brigham Young with real understanding of...
Interesting.
They did put something into the world. Even if what you're saying is the only right thing...
Yeah.
You've gotten something out of it. They gave you a way to look at things. They sent you on a path. Yeah. And so I was thinking that would be really fun to do love letters to the great religious leaders from you.
That's
your
a
handwriting,
fascinating idea.
Keep them in a something, and then, oh gosh, wouldn't that be a fun book?
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. On my Facebook page, when I get some time, I want to do a gallery of Muslims I love, Mormons I love, Jews I love, all these different religions of people I love, even though in the wild we'd be natural enemies, but in actual fact I love these people, you know.
Okay, that's good. I mean, that's yet another kind of a love letter. I'm thinking to the love letters to the people you see as scam artists.
As total scoundrels,
Yes, love letters to the scoundrels.
That's tough. That's almost, I mean, because Brigham Young wasn't just a scoundrel. I think he was a murderer.
Oh, I thought you were going to say.
I think he killed people.
Well, and, so did Henry VIII.
Oh, sure. I mean, but see, I'm not lining up to write
Henry
a letter
VIII.
To him either.
Okay.
So,
yes.
You know.
But still, sometimes the love letters to the people who are just seem the worst.
Irredeemable.
If you start looking through the garbage, you find a nugget of gold here and there.
You fascinate me. You are always looking for the good.
Well,
always looking for the good in people.
I
love that.
I like positive. Well, because I think there is.
Mm.
Buried though it may be, and I think there are a few who are just monsters.
Yeah.
For sure.
Sure.
And not every monster needs to get a love letter. Some of them should just get executed. I do believe that. Okay, thank you for doing this again, and to all of you who are listening, this is Janet Gallen and
David Fitzgerald
saying goodbye for now.